YouTube violated federal law by collecting personal information about kids, and now Google will pay for it. The Federal Trade Commission Wednesday said Google, YouTube's parent company, has agreed to a $170 million fine to settle allegations that it tracked viewers of children's channels using cookies without parental consent.
Nissan has found itself in another scandal over pay to its leadership. On Thursday, Chief Executive Hiroto Saikawa admitted to being overpaid in violation of a scheme from the era of ousted chairman Carlos Ghosn. It's the latest case revolving around financial misconduct at Nissan. Ghosn was arrested last year on similar charges. An internal probe found that Saikawa and other executives had wrongfully received compensation. Saikawa apologized after the news.
The central people's government's position on this bill, at various stages, they respect my decision and they support it at every stage. So whether it is in the very early process of taking forward the bill or two, three months ago in suspending the bill or yesterday in formally withdrawing the bill, that is the same position of the Central People's Government. I hope that they would provide a basis for a dialogue and help Hong Kong to break the current impasse.
WGN Radio's Daily Conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is The Opening Bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the program. It is Thursday, September the 5th, and it's 5:09 in the morning. Thank you for tuning in for another edition of The Opening Bell. Another business day getting underway here. We've got lots of news this morning in the world of business. The latest on the U.S.-China trade war coming up as well, a development in that this morning. We'll get to some of the numbers from stock markets around the world in a second as well. On the program today, it is Thought Leader Thursday, and Don Lloyd is here from Associated Bank. Don is in charge of the capital markets and foreign exchange at Associated, and there has been a lot of developments in the last week around the world, whether it be in London with Brexit, or in Hong Kong, or in Japan, with interest rates and currencies. And we've got lots of questions for Don this morning, so make sure you stay tuned for our Thought Leader conversation coming up momentarily this morning. A little bit later in the program, the latest ag barometer is out, declining sharply as commodity prices weaken. Jim Mintert, director of the Center for Commercial Agriculture at Purdue University, who's overseeing the Ag Barometer, along with CME Group, will join us at about 5:38 this morning to go over some of the numbers from that. Good show for you. Stay tuned for it all this morning. Let's begin on the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk. The opening bell rings this morning after stocks rose at the close of trading yesterday as tensions in Hong Kong appeared to be easing. That happened after the embattled leader, Carrie Lam, fully withdrew an extradition bill that set off months of protest. You heard her comments there in the opening montage. Yesterday, the Dow rose nearly 237 points at the close. The S&P gained about 32. The NASDAQ was up 103. This morning, we're seeing some movement in the futures market in the green. Dow futures up nearly 242 points, nearly a percent. S&P and NASDAQ futures are up around a percent as well. That this morning on news from China, U.S. and Chinese envoys will meet in early October for talks aimed at ending the tariff war that threatens the global economic growth. That being confirmed by China this morning. In Asia, markets are generally in the green, with the Nikkei ending the day up nearly 436 points, 2%. In China, up by nearly a percent. In Hong Kong, the only market there lower. Generally lower, the Hang Seng off nearly 7 points, just fractionally lower today. And in Europe, markets are mixed. In London, lower by 0.5%. In Germany and France, up by nearly 0.5%. And oil in the United States is at $56.30 a barrel, which is up about 4 cents. In addition to the news about China this morning, we begin with some news about another big data breach, this one involving Facebook. Hundreds of millions of phone numbers linked to Facebook accounts have been found online. The exposed server contains more than 419 million records over several databases on users across geographies, including 133 million records of U.S.-based Facebook users, 18 million records of users in the U.K., and another 50 million users in Vietnam. but because the server wasn't protected with a password and anyone can find access to the database, each record contains a user's Facebook ID and a phone number listed to the account. User's Facebook ID is typically a long, unique, and public number associated with their account, which can be easily used to discern the Facebook's user's name. Also this morning, some news about Starbucks. You're headed probably for your morning coffee this morning. Starbucks slowing down. The coffee house giant reduced its 2020 earnings forecast yesterday. The chain said in a presentation at Goldman Sachs that it expects earnings per share next year to come in below what it called its ongoing growth model of 10%. That's a big swing from 9 months ago when Starbucks said at its investor day that it expected growth of at least 13% next year. The pullback spurred a sell-off for a time yesterday, with Starbucks shares suffering their biggest midday decline in 7 months. Starbucks rallied later in the day to close down 1.25% at $95.56 a share. Let's begin this morning on Thought Leader Thursday. Don Lloyd is in from Associated Bank. As I mentioned, Don is in charge of the capital markets and foreign exchange and derivatives over at Associated Bank. Lots to talk about on the world scene this morning. Don, good morning. Welcome back to the opening bell.
Steve, it's great to be here. Happy fall. The good weather has finally hit Chicago, so
yes,
it's good to be here.
Lots going on around the world that we want to get your take on. I suppose the biggest thing, and it's been happening over recent days, is what's happening in London with the UK. Boy, what a show.
Chapter 27 of this novel. I mean, it just continues to get played out and unwind, and still news coming out and lots of things impacting the market. And when it comes to the currency market, the British pound sterling is the mover. There's no question about that. You know, we're at about a 7-year low volatility-wise when it comes to currencies, with the exception of the British pound. And all that's being driven out of what's happening with Brexit, the no Brexit deal, mm-hmm. and now the conservative Tory party that are sort of rebelling against the new prime minister over there. So a lot of things going on.
And to give our listeners just a better sense of understanding here, the idea that there would be a no deal Brexit is what's driving the pound down, right? That's
correct.
That's what's causing the volatility.
Correct. Because there's all this uncertainty of what's going to be the implications of a no deal Brexit. I mean, immediately you're going to have taxes and tariffs on goods that are being moved really on that Irish border. Mm-hmm. You know, that's going to be the only land border between the UK that is left and the European Union. So what's going to happen? Will goods stop? There's just a no-deal Brexit. All of that's going to be, you know, in question. Mm-hmm. So that's where the rubber's hitting the road over in Parliament and what they're talking about. And you have the new leader over there who is hell-bent on leaving October 31st mm-hmm. with a no deal or with a deal, but no deal's fine with him. And he's starting to have some rumblings in his own party, you know, about, well, maybe that's not a good idea.
Yeah, and there's a concern, too, about the economy. We've been reporting over the last year companies are leaving their headquarters in London to go elsewhere. There was a report that even from Europe, from France and other places, so at Dover, where all this stuff comes in, the cliffs of Dover, trucks and inner country commerce would be held for 2 days after Brexit, so they wouldn't have free flow anymore.
This is going to have significant economic impact to the UK. There's no question about it. And the markets are picking up on that, have picked up on that, but it's bleeding over to the currency market. Now you're starting to see capital move, you know, businesses leaving mm-hmm. or whatnot, but you're also seeing capital move. Everyone's taking a defensive stance, but it looks like the end of October is going to be the final day. You know, I will be surprised if they get an extension. They might want an extension, but just remember, European Union has to agree to an extension. I think October is going to be it.
Yeah.
So more to come.
Right. Stay tuned for that. There's lots going on around the world. I mean, you talk about currency crisis in Argentina.
Yeah.
There's a big mess down there as well.
Isn't that a textbook example of what can happen when you have runaway inflation, currency devaluations that are going out of control, a policy and politicians that are involved in out of control spending, some corruption thrown in. It shows you what can happen. And you know, the IMF steps up. The IMF tries to help out, through loans and whatnot. And you know, I think the final payment has just been made into Argentina on that. But out of control. And now, thank heaven, the market sort of sits back and watches that, because Argentina is not a major economic player when it comes on the world stage. But to sit there and see those levers that have been pulled to get them into the state that they've been in, I mean, 50% inflation, currencies that have weakened over 30% in 1 month, I mean, these are pretty extreme moves. And, you know, now the next thing is going to be default. They're already defaulting on their short-term debt. Not defaulting, but they're renegotiating it and extending it and missing payments on their short-term
debt. Trying to avoid default.
Exactly, yeah. Trying to avoid it. So, you know, that's just going to continue to unravel. And before too much longer, the market's going to take a real deep dive into what companies and what U.S. companies specifically have exposure to it, you know?
Yeah, and that's my next question, because we consider Argentina an emerging market, right?
Yeah, sure.
So what if you have exposure in emerging markets like Argentina, what is the play?
Yeah, well, the play is to sit there and take a look at the debt that you have on there and how you're going to shore that up, which you're not. So to either lighten that load up as much as you can or, you know, get rid of it. Certainly not extend it and not increase it. So, that's always been the problem with the IMF. The IMF will step in and make these loans to help situations like this. Countries most of the time are unable to repay those. The can gets kicked down the road. Those debts get renegotiated, and then the way the IMF is structured, you know, it's basically the 189 members of the IMF. The percentage of your loan, and it's all based on the size of your economy. So the U.S. ends up holding a lot of that exposure, the U.S. government, the taxpayers. And if these things get renegotiated, like they did back in 2001 when Argentina basically defaulted on debt back then, the U.S. taxpayer ends up paying the majority of that bill. You know, that's sort of the negative side of the IMF. Mm-hmm. But all of that's, you know, still coming down the pike as well. So we'll see what happens.
There's a familiar name, Christine Lagarde. People who know, who listen regularly know she has been the director of the International Monetary Fund, IMF. She's taken the new job over at the European Central Bank. And the question is, who's going to head the IMF and why do we care?
Exactly. She's slated to leave the end of this month and, you know, going to be heading the European Central Bank. And they haven't have a replacement for her right now. So they're looking at this economist out from Mexico, Carstens. You know, he was the one that ran against her back in 2011. It's sort of a ship without a head right now, or will be soon enough. You know, the role of the IMF, it's there to help emerging countries that are struggling. It's there to address poverty. It's there to sit there and really handle the countries that have pegged rates or non-floating exchange rates. Most exchange rates float freely against each other, but there are some, because of their economic fragility, if you will, that are tied, mostly tied to the U.S. dollar. Sometimes they're tied to a basket of currencies, and the IMF helps address that. The lever that the IMF doesn't have to pull is on interest rates and monetary policy. They don't really control that. And there's a big link between exchange rates and interest rates when it comes to countries. So, you know, they don't have a big tool in their basket where they can really, you know, wham away on that. But yet they have this responsibility for pegged rates. We'll see what happens. I mean, you know, why is it important? Well, you know, the IMF is there as a player and something to help out emerging market countries such as Argentina and whatnot, and they're trying. So we'll see, you know, how that changes going forward. Don't think it will very much. They'll have somebody step in to do it. There's no question about that. It's not going to go away. Certainly has a role to play. But she was a very powerful person and, you know, good leadership. The IMF had good leadership under her. So, you know, the transition will be smooth.
I want to talk to you about negative interest rates briefly, and I know there are countries like Japan is one of them that's having its own bond problems. We look at our bond market as well. Talk to us about negative interest rates and why this is so concerning and why it may be coming to the United States.
It's concerning in my life because I've never really seen it in my life before, but it seems to be the norm. I mean, who would have guessed that the 10-year Treasury note in the United States at 1.5% is considered high in global standards and it should come down even lower than it is? I mean, what times are we living in? And negative interest rates seem to be, you know, certainly they're not the way of the future. It's the present. It's here. Europe has adopted them. Looking at some news and information today about how high net worth individuals over in Europe, they're not moving their money out. They're paying the negative interest rates. It's costing them to keep their money in banks, and they don't seem fazed one bit about it. I guess they are assessing the risk of moving it into other assets is too risky, so they'll sit there and just, you know, pay to keep their money in cash or to keep it in an account.
Right.
You know, is the U.S. going to go that way? You know, certainly the current administration wants lower rates because that interest rate differential between U.S. and, say, European rates or anybody with negative or near zero interest rates like Japan, like Europe, creates a stronger U.S. dollar, which, again, it's two sides of a coin. It's great if you're an importer, but it's not good if you're an exporter. And right now the administration's wailing away on the export side of that, and they'd like to see that differential come down a little bit. Japan is sitting there right. Yeah, the same thing. You know, the inflation is sort of subdued over in Japan. They are ready, even though they have negative interest rates, to take them even lower still, to sit there and try to stimulate their economy along. Right. But how low can you go? I don't know.
And just the conversation about it, though, I mean, I hear people when they talk about negative interest rates, like, oh, okay, negative interest rates. But isn't it something that we should be concerned about? And it's just another symptom of a slowing global economy, isn't it?
It's certainly a lever that can be used in a slowing global economy, and it's certainly a lever that's been used a lot and maybe has been played out. But again, you know, how low can you go? How negative can you go?
Right.
Before people start to economically assess that, okay, the risk is time, you know, to move and get that money out and, you know, in other investments or purchasing things or stimulating local economies or whatnot. I've never seen it before. You know, this is sort of education and news to me.
Mm-hmm.
I find it fascinating. I mean, I'm sort of ending my career or getting long in my career in a time where banking is changing as quickly as it is and negative interest rates globally the way it is and rates are so low. It's pretty much an exciting time to be in the markets, to be honest with you. I wish I was starting rather than sort of getting towards the end, if you will.
Are you on the deep side of the pool, or are you in the shallow end, just kind of waiting around?
Well, you know me. I'm pro America. I'm a big investor in the U.S. I love it, but honestly, I'm on the sideline. I have gotten cold feet. Being on the sideline is a position, as far as I'm concerned. Having no position is a position.
Mm-hmm.
I was quite bullish the U.S. Still bullish the U.S. in my heart. I'm just not willing to put my money behind it just yet.
So you're not willing to put your money where your mouth is?
Not right now, but that's okay. Yeah. I mean, I've missed many a ship. Many a ship have sailed without me, but I've really never been on one that has sunk.
Good.
And right now I'm sort of on the shoreline right now. The ship might move, you know, away from me, but at least I'm not going to be on one that sinks.
All right, Don. How can people get a hold of you and have a one-on-one if they want?
Call me on the trading desk anytime. That number is 866-524-8836, or hit me at donald.lloyd@associatedbank.com.
All right. We'll see you next time.
Great. Thanks. Take care.
Don Lloyd, Senior Vice President of Capital Markets and Foreign Exchange and Derivatives at Associated Bank. It's our thought leader conversation. We do it every Thursday here on The Opening Bell. You can find past conversations at WGNradio.com, including today's. We'll post momentarily with the podcast of The Opening Bell soon after the show ends. And then you can also head over to Associated Bank at associatedbank.com/thoughtleadership to hear more conversations and learn more about our thought leaders there.
Now, WGN Radio's daily conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is The Opening Bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
Good morning again, everyone. Welcome back to the program. It is Thursday here in The Opening Bell, and we are happy to have you along this morning. Farmers' expectations for both current and future economic conditions have taken a tumble in the latest reading of the Purdue University CME Group Ag Economy Barometer. Joining us this morning to go over some of the stats and trends, Jim Mintard, who's director of the Center for Commercial Agriculture at Purdue University. Jim, good morning. Welcome back to The Opening Bell.
Good morning to you, and thanks for the opportunity.
The numbers, as we mentioned there in the open, took a decline. It was a pretty sharp decline. Give us the headline numbers here.
Well, it's been a little bit of a wild ride this summer. You know, I think farmers' perspective of current conditions and future expectations really took a drop in May, back when the planting season was being delayed and prices were low. Then we saw a rebound in the early part of the summer. And then this last month, as prices on the commodities really dropped pretty sharply in late July and much of August, we dropped from a reading on the index of current conditions from 141 to 122. The index of future expectations took an even bigger drop, went from 159 to 125. And, you know, I think that's probably the key there, is what people are telling us is they're worried about the future.
About 400 agricultural producers across the U.S. Are surveyed for this report for the barometer. So it is a pretty wide-ranging survey. You get a really good sample of how farmers are viewing things. You mentioned the headline here, commodity prices. There's a lot of concern there. Talk to us a little bit about whether there are trends there that might change.
Well, the big wild card for commodity prices, especially on the crop side, is weather. You know, the corn and soybean crops were planted very late, not just in Illinois and Indiana, but in much of the nation this year. So as a result, the big concern is what is going to be the impact of late planting on yields. And in particular, as we move into the month of September, there's a lot of talk and a lot of concern about whether or not we'll have an early frost. With late plantings, we need to have a frost that's at least normal, or at least average. And actually, I think in some parts of the nation, we probably need a later than typical frost for these crops to really reach maturity. So even though it's pretty late in the growing season, there's still a lot of uncertainty about yields. USDA is going to release an updated report next week that will give us their first objective yield estimate, meaning that they send some people out into fields around the nation, actually do plant populations and actually look at pod counts and really try and get a handle on what those yields are going to be. So that's going to be our first really good yield estimate this year. And I think there's going to be a tremendous amount of interest in that with respect to what USDA comes up with for a yield number.
And I guess we have our fingers crossed, too, that we don't see any of these potential hurricanes that are forming out in the Atlantic Ocean decide to come up through the Gulf and perhaps rain on a good portion of the United States, specifically the southeast United States. That would add to the weather woes, wouldn't it?
Well, it would, and there's also a lot of concern on the livestock side with respect to what impacts we might see in the Carolinas. North Carolina in particular is a very large hog producer. We've had some problems there in the past with hurricanes, so there's that issue as well. So you're right, the weather is a real wild card here, and there's always some of that here in September, this year more than normal.
Jim, there's some news this morning on the trade issue. We reported earlier China has confirmed there's going to be an October meeting on trade with the United States, and that's kind of driving markets, at least stock markets, up this morning. There's a lot of hope that we'll get a deal done sooner than later. The Trump administration has done this response program with money coming to farmers, but some of that's not going to arrive until 2020. How is that impacting, from the barometer's view, the view of farmland prices and incomes going into the next year?
Well, the MFP program has been pretty supportive. I mean, the dollar amounts for farmers have been quite large. Maybe not enough to completely offset the impact of the loss of trade with respect to China, but still a substantial impact. When we've asked farmers about, you know, how the MFP payments are playing out for them, I think about 71% of them said that the MFP payments had either completely or at least somewhat resolved their concerns about farm income and the impacts from tariffs here in 2019. But about 3 out of 10, roughly 29%, said that really didn't satisfy their needs at all. So there's kind of a mixed bag there. Some people feeling pretty good about what the MFP payments have been able to do. Roughly 30% concerned that it hasn't been enough to offset the impact of trade, loss of trade with China.
Yeah, I was just going to say 3 out of 10. That seems like a pretty big number. It's pretty sizable.
It's a substantial minority, and I think what it suggests is there's really this diversity out there with respect to the impacts. And then we asked a follow-up question, you know, do you expect to see another round of these payments in 2020? And I think that was probably pretty interesting. 58%, almost 6 out of 10, said that they expect to see another round of payments in 2020. And I think that tells us two things. One is people aren't very optimistic about seeing the trade dispute resolved very quickly, even though we do have some trade talks coming up here in October. And then secondly, I think after having 2 years of these payments, people are kind of starting to count on it a little bit. And I think that tells you that from an income standpoint, these MFP payments have become pretty important. Just to put that in perspective, if you take the payment rates vary somewhat by county. If you average across the state of Indiana, for example, those payment rates were $67.50 per planted acre this year. So that's a substantial amount of money on a commercial-sized farming operation.
And generally, overall, I know the survey asked, too, whether or not there will be a deal and ultimately be a resolution to the trade war. I know the numbers kind of hovered anywhere from 77% down to 72%. So that's still a big chunk of producers who feel like this eventually will get solved. But the question is, as you've suggested, is when?
Yeah, and I think there's not very many people that really think it's going to be resolved quickly. But as you pointed out, the interesting thing is farmers are still convinced, at least in our surveys, about two-thirds to three-fourths of the farmers that we surveyed going back to March, and we've been asking that question every month, tell us that they think at the end of the day this trade dispute will be resolved in a way that's actually favorable to U.S. agriculture. So there's still an expectation that from a policy standpoint, two-thirds to three-fourths of the farmers think this maybe is the right thing to do. But clearly in the short run, it's created some income challenges for many producers.
I know the survey, the barometer, Ag Barometer, looks a little forward, even beyond just a year or so into the future. You ask a question about what prices will be like in 5 years. As you look into that crystal ball and have people look into that crystal ball, what are some of the responses there?
Well, we ask people about their expectations for farmland values because that's the single largest asset of most farming operations. And we ask them it two ways. We ask them, what do you think is going to happen to farmland values in the next 12 months to get their short-run outlook? And then we ask them about their longer-run outlook, and we ask them, what do you think is going to happen to farmland values over the next 5 years? And so we looked at the August numbers versus what the responses were in July. In the short run, people became more negative about farmland values with an increase in the number of people that expect farmland values to actually decline over the next 12 months. But we asked them about their longer-term outlook, the five-year outlook. There really was no change from July to August. And actually, people remain more optimistic about that long-run view of farmland values than they were back in, for example, April and May. So we've still got some optimism, long-run, short-run challenges.
There have been, I've seen some news, especially from Nebraska and some of the Dakotas and other places northwest of here, that farm bankruptcies are on the rise again. Do you have any information about how how those stats are falling out?
Well, it's pretty early to get a gauge on the bankruptcy numbers, but probably the more significant factor is the fact that coming into this year, many farms' working capital had been eroded pretty severely. So thinking about the downturn that started in agriculture in about late 2014 and 2015, most farms in the Midwest entered that period with a pretty strong financial position, pretty strong working capital. But over the last 4 years, their working capital has gradually come down year after year after year. And that's where we're at here in 2019. And so on most farming operations, that's probably not going to lead to bankruptcy. We're not going to see a big rise in bankruptcies in percentage terms, particularly when you compare it to a more normal historical period. But what we are going to see and have seen over the last couple of years is people refinancing their operations and restructuring their debt. And what they're doing is taking assets, typically land that was unencumbered, and borrowing against that major capital asset. So we're continuing to see that decline and financial conditions, continued decline in working capital, people restructuring. And what that's going to do is put some downward pressure on farmland prices here in the short run, we think, and especially perhaps some downward pressure on cash rental rates. So that's going to be interesting to see how that plays out this fall. In Indiana, for example, we did see a modest decline in cash rental rates for farmland in 2019 versus 2018, but the decline was relatively small on an average basis. It's going to be interesting to see how that plays out. There's going to be some more downward pressure this fall.
Yeah, back to the debt issue. How are some of those decisions impacting whether or not decisions are being made on whether to make investments going forward, especially large investments?
Well, we have a question that we ask people every month about, is now a good time to make large investments in your farming operation, or is now a bad time? And we use that to generate a farm capital investment index. And that index bottomed out back in May. Again, people had a very negative view with delays in planting season, low prices. That combination gave us one of the lowest readings we'd ever had in that index. It rebounded in June and July. We lost some of that optimism on the August survey, so we were down about, I think, 9 points in August relative to July. But we're still about 20 points higher than we were back in May. So I think, again, that kind of ties back to that five-year outlook on farmland. Longer term, people have retained some optimism, but short term, there's some pressure and some concerns.
Jim, as always, we appreciate you coming on and sharing the data with us. Thank you.
Thanks for the opportunity.
Jim Mintert, who's director of the Center for Commercial Agriculture at Purdue University, with the latest from the Purdue University CME Group Ag Economy Barometer. You can find that online, by the way, at purdue.ag/agbarometer. Again, that's purdue.ag/agbarometer.
You're listening to The Opening Bell on 720 WGN.
On the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk, futures are pointing toward opening gains a little bit later this morning on Wall Street. News from China, the country confirming a new round of trade talks will take place in October with the United States. Dow futures are up 255 points. NASDAQ futures are up nearly 100 points. S&P futures are up nearly 27 points. All three indices up nearly a percent or more heading to the opening bell later this morning. Let's get the latest on agriculture and commodities now. Orion Samuelson is here. Good morning, Orion.
Good morning, Steve. Well, after the two stories broke yesterday on my Reuters computer, I have to wonder if Bayer is wondering why it purchased Monsanto, which is the maker of the weed killer glyphosate. That's the subject of a $1 billion U.S. lawsuits over claims it causes cancer. So Germany will ban the use of the weed killer from the end of 2023 and limit its use before then. Bayer disagreed with Germany's decision, saying such a ban would ignore the overwhelming scientific assessments of competent authorities around the world that have determined for more than 40 years that glyphosate can be used safely. But then another later announcement from Brazil. A Brazilian judge has ordered Germany's Bayer to deposit an additional $69.5 million in an escrow account due to a patent dispute with local soybean farmers in that country. Two hits against Bayer and, well, it's acquired Monsanto. It acquired that company last year. In the grain trade yesterday, we saw wheat recover and end higher. Wheat futures rebounded from a three-month low set yesterday. Soybean futures firmed on news of export sales to Mexico. And corn also extended its slide because of improved crop conditions. Well, today I'll be at the Sandwich Fair and look forward to seeing you. I'll be on stage at noon, the outdoor ag stage. Come join us for fun at a fair that started in 1888. The Sandwich Fair. Have a great day. I'm Orion Samuelson.
Thanks, Orion. You too. Now the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk outlook for Thursday, September the 5th. The ADP private payrolls report for August is leading off our reports today. Analysts expect to see the economy adding 145,000 private sector jobs last month. The weekly look at first-time unemployment claims for the second quarter productivity are out as well today. Economists forecast a 2.4% gain in productivity and 219,000 Americans filing initial claims for jobless benefits. Factory orders coming today as well. The experts are forecasting a 0.9% increase over June. Also on the calendar, the Challenger job cut report. We'll get the EIA natural gas report and the EIA petroleum status report all coming today. And on the earnings calendar, Land's End, Kirkland's Incorporated, Signet Jewelers, Costco Wholesale Corporation, ABM Industries, and DocuSign Incorporated among the companies reporting quarterly financial earnings today. Just some of the things that could move the markets on this Thursday, September the 5th.